guest asks and answers the question, what does it take to achieve sustainable well-being and a happier life? Hello, everyone. My name is Pamela Brewer, welcoming you to this edition of Mind Talk. Lisa Cypress-Kamen is a psychology coach and talk radio show host who describes herself as a reformed depressed person. Lisa is also the author of Are We Happy Yet? 8 Keys to Unlocking a Joyful Life. Lisa, welcome to Mind Talk.
Oh, Pam, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be with you.
So, a reformed depressed person, tell me about that.
Well, I come from a typically or perfectly imperfect dysfunctional family where there is depression, addiction, suicide, all the good things that live in many of our closets. And I happen to have been touched by a very, very serious bout of depression that left me pretty inoperable for nearly a year. This was a couple of decades ago. And it really started my interest and pursuit of finding a better way to live in spite of this diagnosis.
Well, you know, you're saying the subtitle of your book is 8 Keys to Unlocking a Joyful Life. People have spent thousands of years trying to figure out how to access and maintain a joyful life. And you're saying it takes 8 keys? That's it?
I would say it could even take less than that. But here's the funny thing about happiness. It is the pursuit and desire of many, but most of us don't realize that it's the byproduct of doing other things. You know, that it's not, happiness is not the destination, it's the gift or the reward of doing other things.
Interesting. You know, you said just a few moments ago that your life, like so many, had been touched by many painful things. You also make the point early on in Are We Happy Yet? That we do not have to be defined by our history. And so many people believe that our history places us resoundingly in cement. And not only are we defined by it, but it is all never to be changed. What do you say to those folks?
I say it's time to write a new story.
Okay.
You know, and that's hard. I think therein lies the biggest challenge because it becomes changing habits. And I think when it gets right down to it, if you look at the pursuit or desire for happiness, like the pursuit or desire to lose weight or the pursuit or desire to be a better athlete or the pursuit or desire to achieve a certain goal, the only way we get there is adapting a new skill set in order to achieve it.
So the energy that it takes, number one, to believe that you can, and number two, then to go about the business of doing that, how do you come to that place?
Well, I think, first of all, there's the desire, right? So you have the idea, oh, yes, I'd like to have a happier life. Then you place a little bit of attention on that. You set the intention, and then here's where most people fail, is in the action part of it. You know, what are we willing to invest in making shift happen? And that's the action step. That's why most diets fail. That's why people fall short of their goals, is maybe they're not willing to invest the elbow grease and the action in order to make change happen. And it is possible. You know, it's like if the cover of the book is appropriately a glass of water that has a little illustration of being half full or half empty. And that is an absolute truth, right? Both are our two conditions. So it comes down to how we perceive the challenge that's before us.
The notion that people can often get stuck and fail to follow through on their action plans if they actually create them, do you think some of that is about fear?
I think some of it is about the fear of change, but I also believe and have witnessed and experienced myself that it's the fear of vulnerability, because we can't make these changes completely by ourselves. You know, it takes a village. Shows like yours, like mine, the books that we write, the workshops, the zillions of workshops that are out there, really illustrate that it takes a team in order to help change happen. So I think the fear is in letting people see our hand. Like, if you really saw that I was vulnerable and depressed and a mess, that maybe you wouldn't want me.
That is a huge fear that many people have, and it's an assumption that many people believe in.
Yes. When in reality, life is pretty messy. At least the ones that I've witnessed, you know?
So in reality, life is pretty human.
Life is pretty human. It gets a little messy. And I think that as humans, we tend to lack appreciation for the temporary nature of everything.
I think that's very true. In fact, I know that's very true. We do, in fact, tend to believe that if it's happening right now, it is very likely to be happening forever. And I would say that if we're in a depressed state, we're even more likely to believe that.
Yes, and this is a very risky zone for us when we believe that this is all there is and bad things can happen when we're in this place. So the ability to have a little perspective, which is definitely difficult in a depression, and that is where having some form of support, whether it's a peer mentor or a clergy person or going to therapy, going to group therapy, even I think going to the gym and talking to somebody next to you on the Stairmaster or the treadmill can help.
You say that the journey of coming home to oneself is a powerful one. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think that many of us spend our lives seeking the answers to our lives from external sources when we're pretty powerful people. If we just stop and listen, we tend to doubt ourselves. We tend to bypass intuition. We tend to not follow that hunch or the little voice that often speaks to us, particularly when we're younger and we don't know perhaps how to listen. And we end up on a path or a trajectory that may not always yield us what it is we ultimately want. So if the desire is to have this place of happiness, and I think happiness is a really lightweight word for what we're really talking about, which is contentment, a life well lived, the good life, you know, words like that are probably better descriptors, but we use this moniker happiness because it's convenient. But we get off the path of what we're really seeking. So that coming home to oneself, I think, is the discovery of who we are authentically. You know, maybe we went off on one career path because that's what was expected of us, or a life path that was because we thought that was expected of us. And then we wake up one day and we're feeling down in the dumps, or we're feeling depressed, which, by the way, I, in my own experience and what I've witnessed in people, depression is the body and the mind telling us that something that we're doing is no longer working. We need a course correction. It's not a bad indicator unless we don't do anything about it.
The other thing about, I mean, there's so many myths about depression. I mean, we could spend an hour just talking about that. But, you know, one of the things about depression is that those who are in a depression feel so badly about the fact that they're depressed that often skews the energy, sort of drains the energy that they might have to move forward, to even begin to look at themselves in a different way.
Yes. And depression really creates a whole lot of physiological symptoms as well. You know, the fatigue, the brain fog, the sort of, you know, that sense of feeling lost in the world, the inability to get out of bed, you know, the low energy. And this is where that fake it till you make it can come in and be very, very helpful. That and an accountability partner can be truly helpful for all forms of change, not just managing depression, right? So having somebody to whom you feel accountable that can say, hey, did you get out and get some exercise or some sunshine today? What did you do for yourself? I mean, that's at a very elemental, basic level.
But it's also such an important level.
Yes.
You,
very much so.
You give you talk about a Japanese originated art process, and I thought it was such an interesting piece of information to share. Can you explain that to the audience?
Yes, the name of the process is Kintsukuroi, and it means to repair with gold. And the story behind this process, Kintsukuroi, is that a famed emperor had a precious piece of ceramic, and it broke. And the people in his court were mortified that his precious piece, something that he really favored and treasured, had broken. And they set about trying to repair the vessel using real gold, and realized that the reassembly of the broken piece of precious ceramic was actually more beautiful and more interesting and more textural after the break and the seaming, you know, the putting it back together. And I think it can be a very beautiful and powerful metaphor for our own lives.
Absolutely. I was so struck by it because, again, you know, so many people who were struggling with any number of things, whether it's an emotional, psychological challenge or a physical challenge, can find themselves feeling broken and forever broken. And so this really does seem like a wonderful metaphor to remind all of us that broken doesn't mean that you are forever damaged and can never reconstitute, often in a lovelier, more powerful way.
Now, I agree that it is after the storm that we find our greatest strength, and we, you know, we have that sense of coming home to ourselves. Back to the question you had asked before, you know, it's that sort of return to oneself, but bigger, more vibrant, more empowered, and stronger than ever.
So we're talking about 8 keys to unlock a joyful life. Give us a key. What's one key?
Well, the most often spoken of and underutilized one, I think, is gratitude, right? We spend our time focusing a lot on what's wrong with life. You know, that is, you know, part of what traditional psychology and psychotherapy asks us to do, is sort of recall the more troublesome events that we've experienced and go back in time historically, and not so much focusing on the good things in life, which positive psychology really shifts that paradigm. So the ability to stay in gratitude, to really focus on those things that are going right, those small, mundane, simple little things that we often take for granted, including but not limited to that perfect cup of coffee in the morning, or that sunrise, or the smell of the air after a rain. These are things that when life gets messy, we often lose track of.
And, you know, I would suggest that, you know, they don't necessarily change the messy, but they broaden your perspective so that it doesn't feel so heavy, so burdensome.
Yes. Yes. And I think you make a really good point. I mean, we're not looking to poo-poo or minimize bad things when they happen. I mean, this really isn't about trivializing the difficult. It's about creating a paradigm of perspective for it.
The idea that one can, by changing how one thinks about something, change how one feels about something, is a powerful one. It's been around for a while. Say more about the power of that, about learning how to see the glasses half full versus half empty.
Well, there is true power in our thoughts. I agree with that, but I think what's even more powerful is our action. So we can say we want to be happier, all we have to do is think happy thoughts, and for somebody who's truly struggling, I find that that's really, really hard. But if you ask somebody to maybe do 2 or 3 small actions, that will then shift the emotion, because the emotion follows the action, right? It used to be thought, well, if you think happy thoughts, you'll become happier. But it's actually if you do things that will generate more positive emotion, that the thoughts will then follow that. So it can be something very, very simple in the beginning for somebody who's truly been challenged. You know, simple activities that come to mind really quickly are, you know, when was the last time that you blew bubbles or fed ducks or birds, or, you know, did something nice for somebody else?
So really tiny things, you're saying, can make a huge difference.
Yes, because this is how we begin to rebuild trust in our own process, right? That most of us find ourselves in difficult situations as the byproduct of something that we expected to go one way in our lives did a 180 on us, right? It didn't live up to an expectation or a dream or a desire. Perhaps there was a breach of trust or a betrayal. So these tiny little interventions that we're in control of, right? Nobody else is in control of them, give us a very small positive response. Maybe we're willing to trust and go a little bit further and farther next time.
So it really sounds like creating success for yourself. One of the things that I know you and I know is that when you're troubled by something, it feels big. If it didn't feel big, you wouldn't be troubled by it in a lot of ways. So when that thing feels big and troubling, everything around it can feel big and overwhelming. So if you're able to know that you can do something tiny, putting one foot in front of the other can be huge for somebody who's been in bed for a week. That's huge.
Oh, yes. Huge. And it doesn't have to be complicated. You know, just getting out in the sunshine, I know I touched upon that earlier, but this concept of nature bathing, which the Japanese government invested a ton of money in researching because the suicide and depression rates in Japan are very high. They were like, we need to give people some tools to manage their emotional lives. And so they spent time researching what happens when you send people out in nature, when you basically prescribe a minimum, I believe it was, of 8 minutes a day out in sunshine and next to a tree. And if you couldn't get out in the sun, you physically weren't able to get outdoors, what happens if you look at images on your computer of sunshine and trees, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? And the result of the research is that this 8 minutes improves our emotional well-being measurably.
Eight minutes.
That's a really simple intervention.
Eight minutes. That's amazing. You say that our comfort zone is where dreams go to die. Is that true?
Mm. Well, I can speak for myself. I can speak for what I witnessed. I think so. You know, that the happiest people are people that are constantly challenging themselves to learn and grow. So it doesn't have to be, really grueling kinds of discomfort. None of us want that. In fact, we're driven by comfort and pleasure and a real disdain for discomfort. But yet it's that healthy stress, you know, playing the edge of that where we're challenged to really learn new things and stretch ourselves, that is what keeps people happy. You know, that state of curiosity, wonder, and delight, which Martin Seligman calls, you know, in the VIA, and the values in action, that those are part of the strength of happy people.
Curiosity is indeed one of my favorite words. I use it all the time. It gives you, it's such a forward-looking perspective. I think it's wonderful.
Yeah. And what would happen if you say to yourself, for example, I know what the depression looks like. I know what the discomfort and I know what the darkness looks like. But I just wonder if I turned the screw in my mind a quarter of an inch and did something a little bit different, what would happen? Just that little act of being curious can open a window.
And you know, one of the things that I would just add to that is the fact that we all have the capacity to be curious, that it's not about anything except something that we all internally own at birth. I mean, look at babies. Babies are just sort of born. I mean, we're born curious. So the fact that it's something that we all have that nobody can take away from us, and it's so powerful, hopefully just in and of itself, that is a remarkable piece of awareness.
Yes, but when we're in fear, we lose the curiosity.
Absolutely.
Right? The fear grabs us, you know, and throttles the curiosity out of us.
That's absolutely very true. You quote author-songwriter Leonard Cohen, who says there is a crack in everything, and that is how the light gets in. We're going to take a break, but when we come back, we're going to continue and learn more about how to let that light get in with author Lisa Cypress-Capon, author of Are We Happy Yet? 8 Keys to Unlocking a Joyful Life. We'll be right back. Lisa, one of the keys that you discuss, which is going to be really quite challenging for at least some of our listeners, key number 3, more is not always better. I don't know, Lisa. We're living in a world where for many people, more is absolutely better, and more and more and more.
Yeah. Well, I call that the bowl with a hole syndrome, right? That we feel that we can never be completely filled. So bring it on. We need more. And yes, this is challenging for many people. You know, that when is enough enough, and when can we celebrate the things that we have? You know, if you look back on the last recession that many people are still, you know, climbing their way out of, I think that was an opportunity to really look at this, you know, more is not always more. That, you know, we thought we had everything, the bigger house or houses, the cars, the fancy things that we thought would bring happiness. And then when sort of the world went upside down, many of us lost a lot of those things. I don't know many people who weren't touched by it in a very big way.
It's true.
So I think that opportunity to really evaluate what is enough, you know, do I have enough money? Do I have enough affluence? Do I have enough position and stuff? And then once I feel that I do have enough, I can actually get busy on the happiness, because the happiness is really not in that stuff. It's the illusion that it's there.
Well, how do you discover your happiness factor?
I can say that honestly, for myself and a lot of the people that I work with, that it is a byproduct of the journey, you know, and it going back to the journey of coming home to oneself, that you, when you discover you're in your right place, and by right place, it's, you know, doing something that you love. Even if you're not necessarily in a career that you love, are you doing whatever it is that you do with love, with engagement, with awareness, with mindfulness, with a certain presence in your day? Because that's where the joy is living. It's not somewhere over there, and it's certainly not in a set of conditions, although the media allows us to believe so, right? When we get the right car, or we eat the right meal, or drink the right drink, or drive the right car, we're going to have happiness.
Don't forget the right toothpaste now.
Yeah, right, the right toothpaste. I don't know. Is there a happy toothpaste out there?
Probably. And if there isn't, somebody's going to market it in about 4 minutes.
Yeah, right. Right now, it's happening. The race is on. So it is not conditional, right? I mean, when we look at the most joyful moments that any of us could possibly describe, and we each have them, and if we were to all throw them into a fishbowl written on a piece of paper, there would be a theme that would be revealed within seconds, right? The theme of what really brings us that euphoric, blissful, raptured joy. And it's not in the stuff.
It's not in the stuff. So what do we do once we've settled into that awareness that the stuff that we have, that the things we have, is not what joy is about? For someone, for example, who's grown up, who's been fed that diet, that the more things you have, the happier you are. Now what do they do?
Well, I'm the perfect guinea pig for that, the lab rat. I was in a different career. I was in a very different life. I went back to school midlife to become a psychologist because of my own personal journey and quest. The world upended my family, and I realized, oh my, I really better get busy redefining what this is all about, because if I don't have a secure base with who I am, and I don't have a secure base with those things that bring the truest meaning to my life, I am going to be bankrupt because the stuff is gone.
So you were yourself able to experience the ability to change?
Completely. Yeah. I mean, I bounce back from adversity. And by the way, we all have the capacity to bounce back from adversity. The only thing that separates an unhappy person from a happy person, and I'm going out on a limb by saying this, and some might think it's controversial, is not the quantity of bad or good things that happen to the individual. It's the ability to be resilient and bounce back when things don't go right.
And let's sort of tease out that word bounce, because a lot of people think bounce back means that you're miserable 1 minute and in the next minute you've just literally bounced back and it's all good. It's not quite that, though.
No, it is not quite that at all. And I'm glad you asked the question that, you know, bouncing back is really about how are you willing to perceive what is happening to you, work with the emotions that are present with what's going on, seek resources, support, help, however you define it, to buoy oneself when they're going through something that is unpleasant or truly difficult, and then being able to course correct, right? Course correct the path that we're on. And I think each one of us gets that opportunity to do that multiple times in our lives. I mean, that's what Joseph Campbell writes about, you know, about the heroic journey.
You can, in fact, change your course if that's the thing you need to do.
Yes. And in fact, it's essential for the hero to rise. You know, if we look at the hero's journey, which is the theme in most movies that we see, big Hollywood movies, right? These characters we love because we see an aspect of ourselves within them. And when the hero goes through the trial and tribulations, you know, moves from that ordinary life that's no longer working for him or her, and they step into the unknown, which is very, very frightening. And I think most of us would say that about, you know, being upended by life and being thrust into the unknown. And then the hero, in order to become that hero, to step into the hero's, you know, costume with the big cape and the chest plate, has to go through these trials and tribulations, right? Has to slay dragons and meet monsters. And if you look at Dorothy and the Wizard of Oz, for example, the only way she gets home or believes that she can get back home is to follow the yellow brick road to see the wizard. And when she ultimately encounters the wizard, she realized the wizard couldn't help her, but she had the tools to get home all along. All she had to do was click her heels. But the journey is what helped her realize that.
And you know, that is really such a wonderful story to look at the power of how we think about things.
Yes.
You talk about being addicted to numbing. Why would somebody be addicted to numbing?
Oh, well, my goodness. First of all, I think we should point out the forms of numbing that many people don't even think of, because most people go to alcohol and drugs, right? Well, you and I could probably think of a list of a dozen more, including but not limited to our phones, TV, food, sex, shopping, you know, gambling. There are a whole host of others. And I think we spend a lot of time trying to take away the unpleasantries that arise in our minds. Uncomfortable thoughts, uncomfortable memories or situations, and we numb out because it's certainly more easy to derive pleasure from those activities or substances in those cases than it is to really sort of deal with really what's at hand.
So the idea that we just as human beings find ways to not feel the things that we feel, is that what you're talking about?
Yes, It's the avoidance of the uncomfortable feeling and the behavior or substances that we use to numb, because we get a temporary reprieve from the feelings, and we get pleasurable chemicals that are released in the brain, right? So it makes sense why we like to numb with however we numb. And not everybody that numbs is a full-blown addict. I think we need to also qualify that.
Absolutely.
But if we focus on, let's, go out for that turbo shop, during the end of the season sale, if we're not feeling really good about where we're at in our professional lives or where we're at in our marriages or where we're at with our kids, it's easier to go there than sit with the uncomfortable.
Absolutely. Let's go back to the happiness factor. How does one truly begin to discover his or her own happiness factor? Are there questions to ask oneself? I think you have some in your book.
Oh, my goodness. There are lots of surveys, lots of prompts for reflective writing, questions in the book that really give rise to help people suss out ways to get back in touch with their happy place, or to create one if they've never had one. Some people have never had what they would describe as a happy day in their lives. They've had such challenges that the unhappiness is the status quo. It's what they're used to, right? So that's their normal. And to give them a new normal with some positive emotion could be life-altering.
You know, I just happen to have Are We Happy Yet handy, and I am looking at identifying your happiness quotient, and I'm just going to – do you have a copy of it with you?
I do now.
Okay. Well, why don't you grab, take a look at page, starting on page 49, and it certainly goes on 49 through 53. And why don't you share with us some of the questions that you ask, just to give people a sense of some of the questions that are useful to really consider for themselves.
Wonderful. I will do it. Here we go. Number one, we'll start there. Do you repress your true feelings? And the range is from always to never. So this is the kinds of questions that we're asking and hoping people will be willing to answer honestly. Another one would be, do you have mean-spirited and negative judgments of yourself and others? Another example would be,
Let me just stop you on that one. Do you have mean-spirited and negative judgments of yourself and others? How many times do people engage in that with themselves? It's almost stunning.
Most of us have a choir that we were born with that lives in our head that can undermine the good stuff.
Absolutely. Give us some more.
All right. Here is another. This is a simple one. And when we stop to think about it, we may go, oh, my. It is, do you eat well-balanced meals?
That's a question.
Most of us don't feed ourselves well.
That's true.
We don't. And when you think about emotion and body chemistry, if we're eating food that's made with a bunch of products that we don't know how to pronounce, we probably shouldn't be eating it.
and that, quite frankly, is a lot of what's easily available in the stores today.
Yes. Yeah, it's fast, it's cheap, and it's, going to the instant happiness, if we eat this thing now, we're going to be satiated.
For the minute,
rather than delay gratification.
Right. For the minute that it takes to eat it.
Yeah. There we go.
Let's have a couple more. Just a couple.
All right, a couple more. Yes. This one, I think, is number 17. Do you have satisfying and connected relationships? Because this is the cornerstone of where the real secret sauce lies.
When you say that, I just want to talk about that for a second, because many people will say that they have lots and lots of friends, but when they really look at it, their friends may be people who they do lots of favors for, but in a pinch, maybe they're available for them, maybe not. Not sure that's a friend.
Yes, I agree with you. And that satisfying and connected. I mean, most of us have relationships, but when we look at the quality of that relationship, is there a give and take? Is there support that flows both ways? Is there a sense of joy in being with that person or being connected to that person, even though the relationship may not always be joyful? And are we willing to accept, you know, imperfect perfection in that relationship?
Give us one more.
One more. Here we go. Let's see. This is another great, it's in the form of a question, but a great tool here. Do you try to turn negatives into positives by seeing the silver lining in situations?
You know, I find that question can be so powerful, particularly when someone is talking about something that has ended, quote unquote, suddenly, and they didn't see it coming. And a lot of times, if they can look at what they learned through that process, that ending, that relationship, it hurts. There's no doubt about that. But they can also see that they learned something through that process.
Yes, and in that space is where the growth happens. You know, it's hard to grow when things are hunky-dory, right? Because it's that comfort zone.
You talk about self-compassion. Why is that so important?
Oh, because we really are the best abusers of ourselves of all. You know, and I want to qualify that statement by people have experienced abuse in their lives, and it's horrendous, and it shouldn't happen. But we, as our own worst enemies, do a pretty good job of continuing to inflict negative self-talk, judgment, undermining, self-sabotaging ways in the world that do a fine job of perpetuating abuse in our existence. So I do think that is a big factor. And when we can learn to be more friendly with ourselves, that is hugely helpful and game-changing.
So how does one approach that? You know, many people, perhaps not as much in the world today as in the world yesterday, but many people see self-compassion as self-centeredness and not a good thing.
Well, self-compassion can be, you know, cutting yourself a break, being kind and gentle to oneself, and treating yourself in a way that you would treat somebody else who was hurting. You know, you wouldn't kick your friend, you know, or abuse your friend who was feeling down and out. So why would you do that to yourself?
So again, really paying attention to the quality of care that you give others, and then realistically asking yourself if you provide yourself with that same quality of care.
Yes, and at the same time, if you're unable to really do that for yourself, hold a space of love, compassion, kindness, and empathy for yourself, it's difficult to truly do that for others, to truly do it. You know, where it doesn't appear as though it is sympathy, because, you know, sympathy actually separates us from another person. It separates them from their experience, us from their experience, whereas empathy allows us to walk in their shoes.
Say a little bit more about that, just for a moment, if you can.
Well, you know, we say it in the course of conversation. You know, I really feel sympathy, or that she's having a hard time, or sympathy that she's lost somebody or he's lost somebody that they've loved. Well, when we're in a state of sympathy, we are having a bird's eye view of the situation. We're removed from it. We're stepped out of the inner circle of the experience. But when we're in empathy, and I would say compassion also, we are willing to go in, to lean into the experience of another person. And I think when we are able to do that fully and be willing to risk vulnerability, because there goes the V word again, right? That willingness to maybe have some emotion surface and be seen in that state is where we meet in that state of real connection.
For ourselves as well as others.
Yes, for ourselves as well as other. I mean, others. You know, I think that if you think of, and we all have these moments in our lives where we might be sitting with a loved one, or maybe even not a loved one. Maybe it's a client or a friend or a child or your child's friend, and you talk about something that touches that cord, that activates that vagus nerve, that empathy gland, and you tear up, you well up. That is that state of being really connected. You're nowhere else but in the moment with that person, and it's quite exquisite and intimate.
Lisa, we're going to take a break, and we will return in just a moment. So much of what we're talking about today is about allowing yourself to feel what you feel. And I just want to point out a very important point that you make that I think that folks may often sort of sidestep or not pay attention to. And that is the fact that suppression of our emotions, and I'm quoting you now, can lead to a wide range of physical problems such as, and folks, I really want you to pay attention to this list: back and neck pain, headaches, sweating, weight gain or loss, sexual dysfunction, anxiety or panic attacks, insomnia, upset stomach, compromised immune system. That's not a full list, but Lisa, that really speaks to how powerful our emotions are and how much we hurt ourselves when we try to squash them.
I obviously wholeheartedly agree, and I'll tell you something really interesting that when I was going through the depths of this 1 year long depression where I was pretty incapacitated, I had a therapist who was brilliant, and he said to me, you know, depression is rage turned inward, so let's talk about what's really bothering you.
Absolutely.
And that changed everything. Just that question, it changed the perspective on the depression, of what depression really was for me at the time. And I really see the deep integrated value of looking at how our emotional states affect our body. Dr. Bessel van der Kolk wrote a wonderful book entitled The Body Keeps Score.
Yes.
And his work is so magnificent in the trauma, post-traumatic stress and trauma recovery. And this is really what we're talking about. This is the heart of it all.
You know, you mentioned Dr. van der Kolk, and I'm reminded actually of a communication I got from a patient probably about a couple of months ago who was saying that he read the book and it completely changed his life.
Yeah.
His work is very powerful.
Very powerful. When we talk about self-compassion, I think it ties very nicely into it in this way. If we view the body, our bodies, as this sacred temple, right, this sacred vessel that houses all of the software of the human experience, right, our memories, our emotions, et cetera, we need to take care of this vessel. You know, we need to feed it right. We need to be kind to it. We need to love it. We need to honor it. We need to nurture it. And when we don't do that, systems start to fail.
So how do we improve our mental muscle tone?
Practice, 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 right? Practice makes permanent.
Practice makes permanent. I like that.
Yeah. So, you know, often people will say to me, clients that I work with, because I do the majority of my work, ironically, in the dark side, you know, using positive psychology coaching to help people struggle with addiction and trauma recovery. It has to be progressive and relentless practice of those habits and activities that we know, we being that science and research has proven, help people elevate and shift, right? So it's the practice, the daily practices, the self-care that include self-compassion, that include gratitude, that include curiosity, that include exercise, that include really working on shifting the way that we think, because we can teach ourselves old dogs new tricks.
And part of the happiness work that you're asking us to do is to create a happiness first aid kit? I don't think I've ever heard of one.
Yes, a happiness first aid kit. We all need a first aid kit, right? We all have a go-to toolbox of sorts that help us when we have cuts and scrapes, right? If you think of it that way.
Absolutely.
You know, where the Band-Aids and the aspirin live. And I think for happiness to have these talisman or reminders, these symbols of what actually helps us breed and keep and grow our happiness is important. So the Happiness First Aid Kit was a byproduct of a TEDx talk that I did many years ago, called the talk was about flourishing in the new paradigm. So it was after the recession, people were feeling quite broken and exhausted by what they had gone through. So the first aid kit is really this reminder of where does happiness really live, you know? So I'm looking for the exact page in the book, and I have found it. And you can make your own. You know, the ones that we put in ours were a mirror to remind us that change starts from within, chocolate to remind us to eat dessert first, not to postpone our joy, bubbles. I'm big on the bubbles because it makes us go back to a state in our lives when we were more childlike and playful. It reminds us to play every day. Also in the first aid kit are rose-colored glasses to remind us that the way we view the world governs our attitudes and actions. And here's the one that I often get a lot of static for, and I put it in anyway because at least it starts a good conversation, is a package of Kool-Aid. For those of us of a certain age, right, we remember where that came from and what that symbolized, which is a negative event, actually. But sometimes we have to just have faith, right? Take a leap of faith that what we're doing for ourselves is actually good and going to work. Also in our kit is a balloon to remind us that we all have hot air that needs to be expelled from time to time.
That sounds like a pretty comprehensive first aid kit.
Oh, and there are a few more. And then I invite people to put their own in, you know? We all have those little symbols of what happiness means to us.
What are some of the self-soothing techniques that you suggest to folks?
Well, there are many, but the ones that come to mind are the ones that are simple, easily accessible, and free. Because the idea is that you're not dependent upon something else, money or some other someone else's schedule in order to do them. So it can be something simple as a bubble bath. It can be putting on your favorite music and dancing to it. It can be, you know, back to the bubbles. This is something that is next to nothing, or you can make your own even with dish soap. And, you know, something that brings you to the present moment. These activities are meant to actually isolate us from our distress. Right, so separate off the distress. Say, yes, these things are happening. They're uncomfortable. I'm feeling really bad about it. But what's something that I can do to take my mind off of it and get grounded in the present moment? Because what we stress about is usually not what's happening in the present moment. The present moment is usually 99% okay. It's the worry about something that has already happened. So we're looking at life in the rearview mirror, or looking at life through the windshield of the car, something that could be happening in the future, and that's where we spiral out.
And you make it very clear that you'd like for folks to spend as much time being present as is conceivably possible.
Yes, and the reason is the present is usually the only guarantee we ever get in life.
Say more.
Well, the present, if you view the present as the true gift, like right now I'm talking, we're having this conversation, an amazing conversation, and I feel connected. I feel joyful. I feel like we're having an exchange of thoughts and ideas, and there's no place I would rather be than right here. You know, everything else that I've got to do later today, you know, my to-do list and my obligations is somewhere out there. But when I just focus here, I can't be anywhere else if I'm really doing it fully. And that gives me great comfort because I'm showing up for life in this moment.
When you say to let go of regret, which is what you were just talking about, and a moment ago, and negative future tripping.
Yeah.
Say more. Yeah. What do you mean by that?
Well, we are great future fantasizers, all of us, because we have great imaginations. We've got these minds that love to spiral out to the negative. But because the mind is so powerful, we also have the ability to use those same forces to the positive. And this gets a little bit into the brain science because of the brain's predisposition, right, to a negativity bias, which is what helps keep us safe. I mean, that's what researchers believe why we are prone to think negatively, because it allows us to be alert and helps keep us safe. And aware of the enemy or aware of the predator that could be out there, the saber-toothed tiger that chased us eons ago as cavemen and women. So to stay focused in the present does require work. And the regret element, I think that we would all say that regret does keep us from our happy place. We might have remorse, you know, about something that has happened or didn't happen or an event that went on in our lives. But the hanging on to the regret is actually staying attached to something in the past. It's already gone.
So if it's already gone, but you are still feeling impacted upon by it, how do you navigate that?
Well, I ask the question, what's the upside? If we're still stuck in regret or remorse over something that's happened, or let's not even say regret or remorse, in disturbance over something that has happened, it's taking away from our peace or our happiness. What is the upside? What are we achieving by allowing that to happen? Because we can't change it, right? It's already gone. It's already done. But something in the mind keeps us stuck and in rumination. So what is the upside to that? What we must be getting something out of it. Otherwise, we wouldn't keep doing it.
And so
they rub people the wrong way. Sorry to interrupt you about that.
No, that's fine. So one of the things that one might be getting out of it is a sense of protecting oneself, or what might one think one is getting out of it?
Well, I think people say often, well, you know, I have to be really vigilant. I have to be alert so that doesn't happen to me again. And for the most part, lightning doesn't strike twice, so it won't. But once we have the awareness of something that has happened that we no longer wish to experience that again, the next step to make sure that we don't experience that again is to change the way that we operate. The worrying about not wanting it to happen again isn't what keeps it from happening.
It's changing the behavior that has an impact.
Changing the behavior. If it's in relationships, it's like changing the picker. You know, somebody who is a serial marrier or gets into the same kind of relationship cycle over and over again, you know, you have to look at the common denominator. What's the common denominator in the situation? It's usually us and our choices, what we're attracted to, how we pick. And so therein lies the opportunity for the change.
You ask a question, if things are going too well, do you tell yourself you don't deserve it? I think there are a lot of people who get caught up in that. What do you say to those folks? They're just trying to protect themselves from being disappointed.
Oh, absolutely. I think that, you know, there's that element. And also it's like, oh, I shouldn't get too happy because it's going to come to an end. You know, there's the other side of it is if I get it, oh, I'm just going to lose it eventually because nothing lasts forever. And that is true. Nothing does last forever. So the ability to be flexible with events that happen in our lives, and knowing that we may not be 500% happy 500% of the time. But boy, when we recognize those moments, we better hang on and savor them, because the recalling of those moments when life isn't going well is actually a tool. The recalling of positive memory and emotion can actually help shift negative emotion when we're in the downswing.
So if we think that we are protecting ourselves by constantly waiting for the other shoe to drop, so to speak, we're actually harming ourselves and limiting our options.
We're harming ourselves physically and emotionally, because the waiting for the other shoe to drop keeps our body in that state of hypervigilance, where you've got cortisol, the stress hormone, constantly coursing through the body. And it's that elevated cortisol that causes inflammation in the body, lowers the immune system, and compromises us physically. So not only is it affecting, you know, the way that we're thinking and experiencing life, it's impacting our overall physical and emotional health.
You ask a number of really, I think, important and powerful questions in your book. We're going to close out today with one that I would just like for you to address for a moment, if you would, because so many people, I think, struggle with this. Do you have emotionally toxic people in your life? Talk about that.
Well, when we talk about emotional fitness, an emotionally fit person is one that's able to recognize and experience and manage the gamut of emotions, positive and negative. And not everybody is able to do that, right? Not everybody is emotionally intelligent. It's not a skill set that, when most of us were young, were taught to us by our parents or in schools. It is being taught in schools now, which is phenomenal. And many of us don't know how to deal with conflict, don't know how to deal with struggles within ourselves and within our relationships. And we get in a loop responding to life based upon our history, right? That we grew up in a certain dynamic or family of origin, and maybe that's how we learn to deal with conflict. So we bring that skill set with us into our adult life and our adult relationships. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's good, productive, or happiness-inducing.
Lisa Cypress-Kamen. I just changed your name. How about that? Lisa Cypress-Kamen, author of Are We Happy Yet? 8 Keys to Unlocking a Joyful Life. Give us a website where folks can go for more information.
Please visit harvestinghappiness.com.
Would you repeat that for us?
Yes, harvestinghappiness.com. And from that site, you can access everything, the books, the radio, the TEDx talk, et cetera, and how to connect.
Sounds terrific. Thank you so much, Lisa, for spending time with us today. And thank you for Are We Happy Yet?
Oh, thank you for the opportunity to share.
All right. And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service. It is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is available to you on demand by going to myndtalk.org, or you can download the free Mind Talk app from the iTunes or Google Play stores. I'd love to know where in the world you are as you're listening, so send me an email to Pamela, P-A-M-E-L-A, at mindtalk.org. Again, that's myndtalk.org. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. And folks, remember always, if it's unacceptable, then it's unacceptable. You take care.